welcome to another fantastically fun episode of Back for Our Future, the show that goes back to help us in the future.
Exactly.
It'll make more sense. The more you watch it, it makes more sense. Is that fair to say, Tony?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So we're really stoked to have you back joining us again, hanging out with us as we talk about a lot of different things. But our focus on this show, since this is the second episode, is we're talking about a time period, a coming of age story, a time period of the early 90s, and we'll keep spanning until we run out of content. God knows when. But in that window of time, Tony and I grew up best friends, but there was a magical series of events where a movie theater opened, which is now long forgotten. If you haven't seen the first episode, I suggest you go back and watch the first episode as a primer. We're going to jump right into this one. But that movie theater is long gone, not forgotten, but it's been abandoned. And now we saw this and started deciding that maybe we should talk about events. Long story short, watch the first episode to get it. Today on the show, we're very excited. This particular sequence, I'm going to let Tony tee it up because there's a lot to it and there's a lot of absolute stupidity that comes from me in this episode. Take it away, Tony. Tee up this episode. What are we talking about this week?
Well, I mean, this week we get into, 1992. And the start of 1992 is brilliant because we get Wayne's World.
Yeah.
The brilliant movie Wayne's World that comes out on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1992. And Wayne's World is, without a doubt, a classic, which got a sequel, not nearly as good as the original, but
Agreed.
You know, a great hit nonetheless. Saturday Night Live, and we all love Saturday Night Live, especially back in the day. And Wayne's World is a classic, and Mike Myers will be very important to our future.
Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure. Crucial. And this, to kind of tee that up a little bit, this movie is at a high, so 92, I'm a fresh, 92, right? So I'm a freshman in high school. You would be a sophomore at that point, correct?
1992, I am 89 to 90.
Oh, Valentine's Day. No, I'm in eighth grade.
I'm a freshman.
Yeah, you're a freshman going into it. That's right. That's right.
And I'm at Arnold School at this point.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. You're still a College Hill Baptist.
I'm at College Hill Baptist. Yep, and at a grade school. Shortly thereafter, my whole thing changes from being like a kid in a school that's been there since kindergarten at the end of 92 when I start my freshman year. And then I'm thrown into a private school that's completely a whole nother issue altogether.
Right,
different nightmare of its own. All right, so we're going to talk about Wayne's World. Do you want to tee into that, or do you want to tease the other bits that you got in there, or do you have a way to – did you have a flow?
Do you remember where you saw this movie by any chance? Did you see it in theaters?
Oh, yeah, I had to have seen it. I think my dad took me. I had to have seen it in theaters because of the guitar situation.
Right, which we're going to get into in just a minute. But I remember seeing this movie very vividly at Dolphin Street 6.
Wow.
I saw it at Dolphin Street 6. Even though at this point that Carmike 10 is there in Westmobile, I was staying at my buddy Richard Rowland's house.
Oh, got it.
That weekend. So we went to Wayne's World. When I stayed at his house, he lived off Spring Hill. And
let's put a context a little bit to this because it is kind of fascinating to me. So a couple things to note. In the city that we're talking about, where we grew up, it's Mobile, Alabama, where we both grew up. There's an area of town. This is not a zing on Richard by any means, but it's a more affluent area, and it's called Spring Hill. And he's in that general area, somewhere around Spring Hill. It's a very good area. Yeah. The catch to this is, what's that?
Go ahead.
The Dolphin Street Theater that Tony's referring to is on the edge of Spring Hill, arguably stepping into not as nice of a neighborhood. Not saying it's a bad neighborhood by any means, but it's definitely, there's a contrast of a lot of things that happen. So it is interesting to me that here's these two fellas that brave into a different territory to go see a movie. Cause that was the movie theater that served Spring Hill more or less. Right. It's the closest one to them. They don't have to cross the interstate or anything else. Right. It's right there.
Yeah, well, I mean, like we talked about on the last episode, once you're in the more midtown theaters, all those theaters show different movies.
That's right.
So you kind of had to go where that movie was. And yeah. Once we have Carmike 10 on the west in Westmobile, then you get some movies that overlap because there's nothing else on Westmobile. But in the Midtown area there, that's more it's like, okay, Wayne's World is at Dolphin Street. That's where we're going. You know,
interesting choice though that they put it at Dolphin Street simply because of I mean, it's not that it's an urban theater, but it demographically speaking, that theater normally showed more action oriented content. I remember seeing most of my action movies prior to Carmike were at Dolphin Street. It wasn't necessarily like the comedy venue. The comedy right. venue to me was always like Village Six or Springdale or one of those other smaller theaters. Eventually Carmike just became the one out in Westmobile that we refer to. The impetus for the show that theater was became kind of a catch-all. But this one, Dolphin Street, had a lot of action movies. I saw Terminator 2 there. I saw Lethal Weapon 3 there. I think I said this last time, but that kind of thing. All right, so you're staying with Richard, and you guys go see Wayne's World. We obviously knew the Wayne's World skit. If you don't know the Wayne's World skit, you should probably go review that. I mean, I would say watch the movie, but the skit's more important because this is one of the isn't it one of the first that's the transition from SNL skit to live action movie?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's the biggest. You know,
it's definitely the biggest
for sure. But I mean, they've done so many now, you know, but I mean, mm-hmm. it was definitely one of them, unless you want to include like Blues Brothers, you know, Blues sure. Brothers really wasn't like a true SNL. It wasn't really like a true SNL movie, but you know, that was, is technically they were on SNL.
I guess we could argue, though, that if Lorne Michaels produced it, which I don't think he produced Blues Brothers.
No, he didn't. He didn't.
Yeah, if Lorne Michaels produced it, then it's an SNL movie, and I don't remember. Does that make Wayne's World the first one that Lorne Michaels produced?
Definitely an SNL movie, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Wow. So what's interesting to me about that movie is how much of the culture went away with, like, I can do things. I remember walking out of the theater, even with my dad, and we were like, shwing! We would just do all of these things that were in that movie. Even my dad's laughing at it because it's a very boy-centric type film, but we're watching it, and he's laughing at it. So as young men that are 13 and 14, I imagine, or 14 and 15, whatever we were, somewhere in that range, we are looking at this movie and it is like everything we've wanted. Is it Heather Locklear, right? No. It's
Donna Dixon.
Is that who it is?
Donna Dixon is the one that Dina Carvey's character.
That's right. Is it Heather Locklear in the second one?
Yeah, she's in the second, yes.
Okay, so that's why I mixed them up. But yes, so what's her name? Donna Dixon?
Donna Dixon, yeah.
Yeah. So Donna Dixon, you have this...
Married to Dan Aykroyd.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's true.
Oh, that's pretty wild. So you have Donna Dixon, who, like, as a young man, I mean, we're all like, swing, she was hot. So you get this babe that comes in. You have these two idiots doing idiot stuff that are basically acting our age, which is what the genius is of Wayne's World. They're really acting our age when we're seeing this movie. And it has rock and roll, and it has a metal element. And there's things that happen in Wayne's World that I don't think people realize, or I don't even realize until I'm saying them now. There's moments in there. I had never in my life heard Bohemian Rhapsody until Wayne's World. I'm happy to admit that.
Really?
Nope.
I think that was for a lot of people because, like, I was a huge Queens fan back in the day. Yeah. I was a huge fan of that band. And so when I was a little kid, I had vinyl and stuff like that of that band. I loved them growing up. So I knew the song really well. But it did lose its popularity and then regained it for Wayne's World. So people that were younger, like you're 13 years old, you may never have heard it. It's possible.
Oh, dude. It was for me. So I grew up we've talked about this some, like, my mom was not really big into, my mom had a lot of, we had a lot of records growing up, but our records were a lot of soundtracks, which obviously I became a filmmaker. It became important to me. We'll get to that story in another episode. Why that's so important to me is because I got to record a score, and that was something very emotional on a movie you and I produced. But so that hearing that song blew me away. And I can tell, I remember a story. I was with a guy named Mark Rogers, and shout out to Mark. He just got married, I believe, and he's kicking ass, and I'm proud of him. So Mark, it was me, Mark. It may have been Jonathan Green, but it was three dudes. I don't remember if you were there or not, so pardon me. I'm sure there's probably marijuana involved, so you probably weren't there. But we were leaving. This is later on. This is later on. But we were leaving someplace, and in the car, all of us started doing the headbanging, you know, the classic sequence. Yeah. And these rednecks got out of the truck and threatened to kick our ass. I mean, they were so offended that we were headbanging, basically recreating that scene on our own, that these dudes get out of their truck and want to kick our ass, because that's the culture that we grew up in. That's right. The world. You're under constant duress at any given moment that a redneck is going to attempt to try and kick your ass for no reason at all. And that's what we were dealing with. We were just kids having a good time, high, headbanging, like just stupid stuff. And they just thought it was the greatest thing ever to try and kick our ass. So.
Yeah, I definitely wasn't there that night, but I've been there on many of those kinds of evenings for sure.
Oh yeah, there's a great story about that Suzuki sidekick we'll get to one day and a Limp Bizkit song. All right, so back to Wayne's World. So you're at Richards as a show. If you guys don't know, these are compressed stories. We're just going through them. You're at Richards. You guys decide to go see it. Who was the guy that led that charge? Was it you and because Richards pretty witty. He's a really funny dude. Funny.
We both liked Saturday Night Live, and we both wanted to see the film. So it was pretty easy choice that night. We were both fans of Mike Myers. We were both fans of Dana Carvey, and we liked, you know, we just wanted to see it. And we were friends. We're still friends. I talked to him yesterday, but it was just one of those things. Like we would, you know, sleep over at each other's houses and stuff like that, and go over to Carmike 10 in Westmobile. If you sleep over at my house, or I would go to one of the more midtown theaters if I'm sleeping over at his. And so we ended up at Wayne's World. His dad dropped us at the theater. His brother.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. So I wasn't able to drive at that point. I was still 15.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it was, and he's younger. He's slightly younger than me. So it was.
He's close to my age.
He's in between. Middles us. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, so that was kind of what happened there. And then, of course, don't ever forget that Tia Carrere was in this movie too.
I know. I was gonna Tia Carrere it up
because I had a giant crush on her, and I'd actually work with her later on.
Oh, what did you work with her on?
I did a movie called Torn Apart with her, like a Lifetime movie.
Yeah,
in 2004 with her and Richard Berg. Yeah.
And she's a delightful person, right? Is that correct?
Really sweet. Yeah, she's really nice. She's really nice, very professional, and was awesome to work with. Yeah.
That her performance in that movie is really great. I, again, the music was such a big part of that movie to me. Arguably, Wayne's World is almost a musical in spots because of how important the music is. And there's music montages that arguably follow in narrative filmmaking, follow the pattern of a musical more closely than they do just being random montages in the middle of the film. And there's a great sequence with her playing that there's a man in the back. I don't remember the name of that. A ballroom blitz.
Yep.
And Ballroom Blitz, her version of it, is the only version I'd ever heard of that song. And it's rock and roll. It's got a little punk rock edge to it. And you hear the original version, and it is not the same.
Right.
Is not even close to the same. And it's a much more mellow song compared to hers. And I always felt like hers was like a better representation of how great that song really was, is Tia Carrere's version, which only exists in Wayne's World and only exists on that soundtrack, which was a big deal too. I think there's some Aerosmith on there. I don't remember who all was on that. That soundtrack was it was one of those. We are starting to get into the era here on the Wayne's World soundtrack of these stacked soundtracks where you get original songs or you get these really great collections of artists on these albums. And I believe Wayne's World was one of those. Is that fair to say?
It's loaded. Yeah, for sure. Without question. And then even there's more songs in the movie than there are just on the total soundtrack itself. So
it's a musical.
You know, that's one of those movies that you definitely watch and you go, oh man, I recognize every song in this movie. And that's kind of a cool thing. And that's one of the things I feel kind of, not all movies, but movies that are today tend to get away from that a little bit.
Yep.
A little bit more. Soundtracks aren't nearly as big as they used to be. You know, I mean, it's harder to find them. It's harder to locate where they are in a lot of ways, you know? So it's, like it's used as much.
I'm with you, and I feel like the real shame is that, to me, is that, and again, we're comparing, but it's not a I don't think we're downsiding anybody, but because artists change, right? Times change, the ethos change. But like, to me, the biggest drawback, the biggest frustration about it is what made the soundtrack unique in this era. And I'm going to say it's really, there was other movies with soundtracks, but really in the 90s, it became a trend. There's like A&R people signing all kinds of bands, and that band's first appearance to the general public, they might've had an album out, is on a soundtrack. There's a lot of bands that way. The Crow is a great example that comes out later on, but The Crow is another example of bands that I still listen to that I didn't know about then. But this one, what was really interesting about it, or in general, the soundtrack concept is that the music was as important in the movie. It was never just background score because they invested so much in the soundtrack. It would be like if Taylor Swift, as big as she is, if she produced one or two songs that were extremely unique to a movie soundtrack that only exists on that soundtrack, people would go see that movie because of that song being in it. That's how this era was too, right? Not era's
tour. Absolutely. And compilations were a big deal, especially back then, because that's how you sold albums of other artists, you know, because people would hear a song, they'd get interested in that artist. I mean, for us, it'd be like going back on off The Crow and listening to for Love Not Lisa.
That's who I was thinking of, yeah.
Like that, you know what I mean? Like, we'd never really heard that band up until that soundtrack.
Right.
So all of a sudden, here we are. We hear that, and it's like, oh, we got to go listen to this album, and then we did buy it. You know?
No, 100%. Right. There's on the music side of it, it's really interesting because, again, as I've jokingly been saying, and it's now my official statement and stance that Wayne's World is a musical, especially after this conversation, there's a very key piece of personal history that comes out of this movie, which is the guitar in Wayne's World. And you maybe even have more story recollection than I do. I just remember there's a sequence of Wayne's World where they sit down and he's playing this white Stratocaster. It's an ivory white Strat, beautiful guitar. And he sits down and he plays it. And there's this thing that pops up and it says, no Stairway or whatever. Cause he starts playing Stairway to Heaven, which for me, a kid that didn't grow up listening to Led Zeppelin, was also an introduction to Led Zeppelin. Cause I didn't fully understand the joke till I listened to Led Zeppelin, so forth and so on. But I became obsessed with that guitar, obsessed with it. And I still own it. I have it. It's not here in my office. I wish it was. I need to bring it to my office, but it's in my home office. I have that guitar. Now it has a bunch of stupid punk rock stickers on it. Like there's a Pillsbury Doughboy where the toggle switch is on the Pillsbury Doughboy. I purposely did it so that when you flip the toggle up, it looks like the Pillsbury Doughboy is, you know, happy to see you. There's stupid things like that. It's a punk, but it's still that Wayne's World guitar. And the reason I say it's very special to me is because that guitar led me into the music side of things. And you guys will learn one of the memories I do have, and we've talked about this, but one of the memories I do very much have is my connection to becoming a filmmaker starts with music. And it started with me wanting to play guitar throughout a series of events. I don't remember exactly all of them. I'm sure you could tee this up. I'm sure there's a gag in there somewhere, but that guitar led me into getting into music, which then led me into finding different artists and charging ahead. One of those being Helmet, which is arguably my favorite band of all time, though I don't listen to them as much anymore. Sorry, Paige. I still love Helmet. I always appreciate them, but their album Meantime launched me into it. So that's a big tangent to say this movie is very important to me as a filmmaker because I can draw a direct line back to the guitar, and the Wayne's World guitar got me into music, and music got me into film eventually. And then there's a deeper connection to that with Helmet itself. But circling back, the Wayne's World soundtrack was something that I received in Columbia House.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
Now, Columbia House has a lot of history. Were you a Columbia House guy? Did you have the same thing?
I mean, at some point I had both of them, right? Like Columbia House and BMG.
Yeah.
I did both of them at some point, you know what I mean?
Right.
Where I got which CD, I couldn't really tell you exactly because I've done both of those things multiple times.
Can you tee up what that is though? Can you tee up what these are? Cause there are some people that are hearing this that don't know what it is.
No idea. I'm sure there's tons of people that have no idea what these are. So there used to be companies that you could join basically through the mail where you would get like 10 CDs for a penny, provided you joined their club. And it was Columbia House and BMG. And depending on the deal, it just depended on the company and what deal they were offering at the time, you would get several CDs, and you could pick out whatever was on there, and you get them for like a penny.
Or cassettes.
Or cassettes, yeah.
Yeah.
Or cassettes, yeah. And
started out with tapes.
And to be real honest with you, I started out back in the day when it was vinyl.
Holy smokes.
We joined Columbia House back in the 80s when it was vinyl originally. So, it depends on the era that you joined this. And
right.
You get, but the catch to this was, you were now part of Columbia House or BMG, which meant that every single month they would send you a card that would have whatever selection from the genre of music that you chose, you would get this card. If you didn't send it back, and lots of people, tons of people, would just not send these things back, they would send you that selection. So now you are getting their selection of the month. Well, you'd either have to send the thing back, or you would have to pay for it. And once you got your 9 or 10 CDs or cassettes or vinyl, you are now paying full price for these selections, which was like now $20.
Some of them were like $25. I remember how expensive they were. They were so inflated price wise. It was like this crazy price thing. Yeah,
and it depends on the company. You had to buy one of those and buy one for like half price or something like that. It just depended on the. But that's what you got. And so I knew a lot of people that had great credit, wonderful credit, but would end up with some random Columbia House or BMG black stain mark on their credit because they didn't pay any of this stuff off.
Yep. The best part was...
Yeah, but somebody like this.
No. The best part about all of this was Columbia House didn't... This is back in the day when they didn't have... They didn't have a way to age verify anyone. So any of us could sign up. So here we are, 14, 15 years old. We're signing up for these deals. We're not reading the fine print, right? And it turns out that they can't hold you responsible because you're a minor that signed this stuff. So essentially, you just be like, cancel it. I'm not paying anything. They would send these notices of like, well, you owe us $220. And be like, I'm not paying it. A minor signed up for it. And so they had to eat it. There's no legal way they can prosecute you because there's no parent signed it. There's no co-signer on these things. So essentially, if you knew that, then you were just stealing tons and tons of CDs for a penny, right?
There's a wonderful episode of the show, The Goldbergs, dedicated to this very topic.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And where he keeps signing up under different aliases.
That's fantastic.
Just so you can get this deal.
Yeah.
And it's pretty brilliant.
It's genius.
Yeah.
I remember getting tapes and like the first round of tapes I got was Wayne's World. It was Extreme, Three Sides to Every Story. I can't remember all of them, but I do also know that Helmet Meantime was in there because a friend of mine was listening to it and I really liked it. And maybe there's a Smashing Pumpkins or something. Maybe not Smash. I didn't listen to that album of Smashing Pumpkins, but whatever it was, those three were in there. Now, Helmet being the most important, Wayne's World being the connection, Helmet being the most important because Helmet is what really got me excited about music. This is really heavy album. And back in the day, kids, we had to like look stuff up, not on the internet, didn't exist. So I would read magazines that Paige Hamilton, this guy who's playing this really heavy punk rocky hardcore, they called it grindcore, they played this music, was also a jazz musician. So then because he played jazz, I suddenly became interested in jazz, which led me into like, I never considered jazz in my life. And then all of a sudden I was really into jazz, Charlie Parker, especially, like not even related to guitar or bass. And then I was like Duke Ellington. And then I just Buddy Rich eventually, because I became a drummer. But long story short, that tape from that Stratocaster led me in that music. But there's a great story that unfolds from this. Fast forward in the future a bit here.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Teeing it up. So Tony and I have been lifelong Helmet fans. You should probably share the story before we go into the aftermath. There has been a piece of this. So both of us get into Helmet. We're both listening to Helmet at this point. We both love it. So Wayne's World has led us to Helmet. You see the connection, the guitar, all the stuff. So we're listening to Helmet. But there's a bar in downtown Mobile called Haley's. And inside this Haley's, there's a poster for Helmet and L7. Do you remember anything about that show? Because it would have been when we were young men.
I never remember going to that show. I mean, I definitely didn't go to that show at
yeah,
all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We didn't attend the show at all. Right. What drew us to the poster was the fact that Helmet down there. And we were like, Helmet played here? And we never saw them. You know?
It
was that kind of thing that led us to constantly look at this poster. Because we liked both those bands.
Yep.
And so it was one of those things where, like, dude, this show happened in Mobile. We never got to see it. What happened? Like that, you know, it's one of those, it was just a fascination that, yeah, there were really cool bands in Mobile. We didn't necessarily get to see them.
Yeah. Yep. And it was one of those ones, like, especially that band, because we had connected to it. Right. Obviously, like, we were both really into Helmet. I mean, we had both had different favorite songs on the album. But I think yours was Ironhead. A long time.
Yeah. Ironhead's my favorite song, but it's still a great album start to finish.
It totally is. Totally is. So anyway, so that poster exists in Haley's. Now, Tony and I fast forward a bunch of years. That poster is always in the back of our mind. Here we are. This weird scenario happens where somehow, one day we'll go into more detail maybe. Somehow I get an opportunity to direct a movie. Now, Tony and I have worked together. We've been doing commercials. We've done some short films, some corporate short films. I mean, like they were real shorts. They were narrative shorts that had corporate backing. So it wasn't like a weird industrial. This was actually like comedy driven. So we've been making content and growing off each other. So now I get this weird deal. This guy offers me a chance to direct a movie. I called Tony. It was very restrictive. This movie had a lot of restrictions on it, like worse than any studio that's ever existed. The casting was already done. I'm not trashing anybody either, but the casting was already in place. There was very few options that Tony and I had as a creative team on this movie. We didn't even get to pick what cameras we filmed on. We didn't get to pick the locations. It was all kind of just handed to us and said, hey, your first movie is this. Go for it. And I'm like, Tony, I'm making a movie. You're coming with me. If I'm going down, you're going with me. So we're getting ready to make this movie. So right before production, we go, and Helmet is now playing in Mobile, Alabama again. A place called, I believe, a Soul Kitchen.
It was Soul Kitchen. As a matter of fact, it's the front of Soul Kitchen, though, not the back.
The small part.
It's important because that's what allows us to really do what's coming up next.
So Tony and I go to the show. We have Flynn with us, who's our production designer. We're all like Helmet fans, and there's like a group of us, and we're going to the show, and we're super excited. We're all getting ready to go. We get in there, and Helmet starts playing. This is pre-kids for me, and so I've got permission to be out all night. Helmet starts playing. We start drinking. Not gonna lie, there was some beer served. We had some alcohol. Had a good time.
We're of age at this point. Way of age.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, we're young men. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're post 30 at this point. So we have a couple beers, and I don't know if it was Tony or me, but I can just tell you there was a look exchanged, and I've known him long enough that when either one of us exchange this look, something's about to happen. Do you want to tee this up for me?
Yeah, I actually remember that night pretty well. I mean, I had a couple beers, but I wasn't by any means intoxicated that night. So I really wanted to hear the song Ironhead. He had yet to play it that night. And so I went up there to the front of the stage and requested that song.
Right.
And then when I got back, they started playing. When I got back to you, because we were in the back of the venue, when I got back to you, they started playing that song. Like, they got us to play Ironhead. You got them to play Ironhead. I was like, great. And then at one point, we did this look that you're talking about.
Yes.
And then I was like, dude, he does soundtracks. Can we not just go talk to him and see if he'll do our soundtrack?
Yeah.
You're like, that's a great idea. I'm going to go talk to him. And that's how this all came about.
Yeah. So So as a story, just imagine being an artist. You're a musician that's traveled the world. You're playing in Mobile, Alabama, in the front of a club, not even in the full club. One dude's already come up to you and asked you to play a really deep cut album, a really deep cut song. So at least you know he's a fan. And now another dude is barreling towards you with a slightly drunk grin on his face saying, "Sir, I'd like for you to score my movie." And he said yes and literally gave us his agent. And I'm here to tell you that the three of us had a wonderful evening talking, and we had a wonderful evening talking about, there's photos. I'm sure we can throw them up here for us. But the really big bit about this, the thing that was absolutely amazing to me, is Page was my hero. I mean, he was very important to me. That album was very important to me, not just as an artist. Like, I went through some dark times and really struggled with some heavy stuff. So the song Unsung has a suicide element to it. Not against it, but I struggled with a lot of suicide issues, and that song really helped me. I mean, it was a big deal for me. That song is emotionally part of my career, but it's also influenced me as a creative and led me down this path. And the guy who I look up to most in the world as an artist has just said, yes, he will help score my movie. Now, I don't know how the hell this is going to work. We don't have a clue, but this happened. And for him to do that, we went on and worked on, let's see, five projects together, four features and another high-end short film thing. We did that. We did four features together, one of them being extremely important, which we'll touch on later date. The fact of the matter is that we did that, that Tony and I pulled this off. It got to a point where, like, I can text Paige. Like, he's a friend that I can text and have a conversation with and go back and forth. And then he introduces to a gentleman named Patrick Kirsten. Patrick is this insanely great composer at USC. And we build all of this off of just one decision. But here's why I'm saying it's important that nothing is ever to be taken for granted in your life, because that, I'm drawing it right back, folks. Seeing Wayne's World and that Squire guitar led me into music, which led me into Helmet, which led me into that, became me a filmmaker, that saved my life, that turned me into finally walking up to my hero and saying, like, "Hey, you want to maybe score our movie?" And he says yes. And then years later, he's held my children. He's become a very good friend. It's one of those things that, like, if that's why this show exists. Looking back is to say that you never know what's going to happen on the future side of it. And I think that's a huge deal. Wayne's World is one of the most important films of my life. And it's a freaking musical. I'm just going with that.
It's a great film, man. It, you know, that whole, and then, you know, Paige would come in town every once in a while. And then we saw him in Pensacola. We hung out at Captain Funds and had his little tour bus and stuff like that. But then but then he also came in town just for a visit.
Yep.
And that's how we ended up back at Haley's one night.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And we had a few cocktails that night for sure.
Oh, he definitely did. There's a Josh Holland. Shout out to Josh if he listens to this. Josh Holland, I think, is the poor bastard that had to escort Paige back to the hotel. It was rowdy. We got rowdy, son. It was rowdy. But there's a great picture that will be posted on our socials for you guys to see. And it is me, Tony, and Paige Hamilton holding that mother truck and poster. Keep the show PG, folks. Holding the poster that mattered so much to me and Tony. That was like that. I have goosebumps. You can't really see them. I have goosebumps on my arm because that moment was like, oh my God, Tony, we are literally making movies. We have, this is after the first one. So Paige has already scored a movie. We have scored a movie with one of our favorite musicians ever. They're here hanging out, and this is all happening in real time. Unbelievable.
Yeah, they let us take that thing down off the wall.
Yeah, it was clearly discolored.
I don't know how long it's been there, many years.
That's correct.
Probably never moved ever.
No.
And taken down off the wall, and we all have a picture together of him holding that poster and us around him. It was pretty cool.
That was unbelievable. Yeah. It's a great thing. And that's Wayne's World, right? That's Wayne's World.
I had a couple questions, though. What point after do you get that guitar? Is it right after you see the movie?
Yeah. So I don't remember exactly when that guitar came out for public use, but I believe that guitar came out pretty quick. And it was a Squire, and I think it was a Taco Squire, which means in guitar terms, a Squire is a lower end Fender. And then a taco is a Mexican made. That's the language they use. So I apologize if that's offensive to anyone. I didn't mean it to be that way. But it was, so it was a Mexican made Squire Fender guitar. I believe I got that in eighth grade because that's when I was listening to Helmet. I really got into that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I remember it just kind of shows up. And you're like, I got the Wayne's World guitar.
Yeah.
And I remember it came with like multiple stickers.
Oh, it did. I wish I had the, I wish I would have kept the stickers.
Yeah. They had like Wayne's World stickers and like maybe Wayne's World was on the pamphlet or something like that.
No, you flip the guitar over on the neck where the neck plate where it screws in. It is embossed Wayne's World. Yeah, sure is.
It's been quite a few years since I've seen that.
I'll take some pictures of it and definitely send them and you can post them on socials because it is pretty cool. I kept that guitar because I like that guitar. I played in multiple punk bands with it. I mean, it has lived with me for a long time. So it's a big part of it.
But you hadn't really played guitar until you got this, right?
No, that's literally Wayne's World is the impetus of me caring about playing music. I played piano like as a little kid. This is what gets me into music and basically leads to my film career. I mean, it's 100% tracked back. My career now is an ad agency guy. Like it all goes back to Wayne's World, yeah. Weirdly.
And then you become a drummer.
And then I suck at guitar. That's the real truth of it.
You're self-taught.
I'm self-taught and I totally suck at guitar. So then I became a drummer. So I definitely abandoned the guitar and became a drummer for sure.
And then in any band that I was in with you, you were a drummer.
That's correct. Every band you're in. It's funny because I was talking about this the other day. Tony and I were in this really bizarre band. Side note story and we'll continue on. We were in this band called Lost in Franklin. And they were called Lost in Franklin because we had a friend. Shout out to Jay Bloom. Jay worked at a music studio and it was a good studio in Nashville. I think it was the studio where they recorded it was like Willie Nelson's studio, something really crazy. It was like a really prestigious country place. Do you remember who it was?
I don't remember who all recorded there.
It was big though. It was wild.
Yeah.
And so we have a chance to go up there and record. So it's me and Tony and Horst.
Yep.
Jeff Worley.
Yep.
Jared Jones, maybe?
Jared Jones. Yeah.
So there's a group of us. We're in a band together. We have no name. We're just going up there to record because Jay says he can give us recording time. And we had a couple of songs that were really, like when people heard them, they really liked them. They connected to them a lot. So we go up there and we're going to just record a little three song demo. And we get up there and they change the schedule and Jay can't record us anymore. So we drove 8 or 9 hours for no reason to Nashville, but we didn't even make it to Nashville. We were in some little town called Franklin, which come to find out Franklin's like the Spring Hill. If you flash back to an earlier reference, it's like the Spring Hill of Nashville. So we're driving around this really wealthy area and we're all punk rockery, not looking dudes, but we're all just kind of, you know, punk rock type guys. And we're driving around and there's like a mariachi band doing a wedding on the side of the road. We're very confused by what we're seeing in this downtown area. And so we end up calling our band Lost in Franklin. And we did. I was a drummer. Tony was a singer. And Horst was a singer. It was just this weird party band.
Yeah.
We get back and we play a show. And the show is insane. Like a lady literally rips Horst's pants off.
That's right.
He's like standing on a bar because we were rowdy. And she rips his pants off. And he had breakaway pants. So he's now standing on the bar in his boxers. Tony's rapping. I'm playing the drums. Jeff is doing the Jeff bass thing. It just was one of those scenarios of like, we ended up that again, I blame Wayne's World for all of this.
Wayne's World, definitely a big part of it. I end up working with three people from Wayne's World.
I did not realize who'd you work with on that?
So obviously I worked with Tia Carrera, who we've already discussed. Yep. I worked with Colleen Camp, who plays the arcade owner's wife.
Oh, right.
And I worked with Davey, who was Michael Haggerty played the role, and Davey's the customer and Stan Mikita's.
Oh yeah.
And of course, Michael Haggerty would be in another massive Mike Myers film that would come out a year later.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
We'll talk about in great detail when we get to
That one. There's a lot to that one for sure.
I worked with all three of those guys and Michael Haggerty passed away in the last couple of years. But he was a wonderful guy, and all three of those people were delights to work with. Different projects for all of them, but yeah.
It's interesting. It's an interesting time in movies in general, though, because this is an era of film where lots of I would argue like experimental processes were happening, not necessarily experimental filmmaking, because Wayne's World, although told by a classic punk, I mean, that's Penelope Spheeris, if I'm not mistaken, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, yes. She does Decline of Western Civilization Part 2, which is the most punk rock movie ever made of punk rock movies. It is the definition of punk rock movie. And she goes on and makes this, and it's interesting, but during the time frame, that's a classic sort of studio film, if you will, at the time studio, not now. Studio film. But there's some interesting things going on. I do remember, this is the window, if I'm not mistaken. Didn't we have an opportunity back then to do like these preview type things where we would like, it wasn't like a preview we had now. It was like you saw two movies or something. Do you remember any of this stuff?
Yeah, for sure. So back in the day, studios would have the ability to go see one of their movies that would be out in a week or two, you know, something like that. I'll give you an example. I saw in 1992, I saw Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
Chevy Chase?
I saw that movie. And when you saw that film, you got to stay and see another movie that was playing in the exact same theater. And in that situation, I saw Shining Through, which was Michael Douglas, Melanie Griffith. So it would be like, and it was advertised that way in the paper, which is obviously we look at our movie time on phones now, but back in the day we had newspapers.
In
you had
the
to
paper.
Look up movie times, or you had to call a number.
Oh, you could do the number! I missed the number though. I missed it. I miss the anticipation of waiting to finally hear what effing movie you wanted. You're like, man, I've been waiting for 7 minutes for them to finally get to this movie. Yeah.
But they would have an ad in the paper that would be like, oh, you could come to see Memoirs of the Invisible Man, stay to see Shining Through.
Now, let me ask you something real quick about this. Memoirs of Invisible Man. I kind of remember it.
It's a good movie.
Is it a comedy?
So it plays as kind of a comedy action drama type scenario. I mean,
okay.
It's kind of a mixed bag with him because it's Chevy Chase, so you're getting a little bit of his sarcasm, but also, you know, a lot of it's him and Sam Neill, and Sam Neill's chasing, you're still getting like the Invisible Man storyline,
right? But my question is Shining Through is a drama, is it not? Isn't it a hard drama?
It's a spy drama.
Yeah.
Right. So it was kind of like they weren't always they didn't always make sense to go together, but they did. You know, I mean, like you still get to see another movie. Sometimes it would be comedies on top of, you know, but a lot of times, like I saw Cutting Edge, and, you know, stay to see, like, I think in that case it was Stopping My Mom Will Shoot.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. So I saw
that's a second reference to that in two episodes, by the way.
I know. It's a big movie. Stop My Mom Will Shoot's important.
People need to go see that.
You'd be surprised how often my mom and I reference that film.
That's hilarious to me, man. That's so funny to me.
But in this case, I reference it because it was part of this scenario where you would go and you would, you know, see a movie, stay to see another one. And I kind of miss it, you know, but I mean, I'm the guy who will stay and do double features and triple features anyway.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Not advertised.
I just, not as advertised.
I do them.
Yeah.
They're my own double and triple features. But this was always like something that you could do, and they don't do it now. You know, you don't see it. It's pretty much because the studios had trouble divvying up the money for the box office.
Right.
You know, it's like back then it was hurting a certain movie to see it at a preview time. They weren't giving that to the box office. They'd give it to the box office for the movie that was afterwards. And so it was, it kind of made things kind of convoluted. I think it kind of hurt a couple movies. And so they don't do it as much anymore.
It's interesting. Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. The only time you see that is like at specialty theater type stuff, like an Alamo Draft House or somebody that has like a little more liberté to kind of do things. That's it. I didn't know. I remember that. I remember doing, but as we've mentioned before, I am not necessarily the best movie going extended viewing partner, because dark theaters and me, and if the mood is right, I'm going to sleep. And we know that. Yeah. I'm out fast.
Oh, it can happen. It can happen to anybody. I mean, I'll sometimes be sitting around with, you know, if I'm at a movie with my mom or something like that, she'll dozing off over there a little bit. Yeah. You know, it happens. Yeah. I mean, especially nowadays, because back then you'd have, you know, stadium seating or just like the level seating, the original level seating. Now you get, you know, recliners.
Oh, dude, the recliner is the worst thing to ever happen to me for movies.
So you're not getting up and better armrests and things of that nature. So that makes it a little bit even more conducive to the sleeping environment.
No, I totally get it. So if Wayne's World for me is an impetus for the film career, do you have a movie that kind of maybe helped entice your way into the movie business? Do you have anything like that in your repertoire of stories there, old, great one, wise wizard you?
So back around this time frame, and it would come out in May 8th of 1992, was a movie called Crisscross.
I don't even know that. Who was in that?
You had no idea who was in it. When I mentioned this before, you were like, I've never even heard of it.
I still don't.
It's a Goldie Hawn movie.
Okay.
And it's actually got a pretty good cast, but Goldie Hawn is the star, and it's a drama. It's a straight up drama. And what was happening is it filmed in Miami, Florida, and it came out in 1992, but back in like late 1990, early 91, there was a audition. Trying to find somebody to play her son and or a bunch of his friends.
Right.
And so my mom saw this thing in the paper and was like, do you want to even go in and do this? And I said to her, I go, sure, I'll audition for a Goldie Hawn film. It sounds great. You know, I love Goldie Hawn. And so I went to Pensacola, Florida with my mom and two friends who I'm not going to name because I haven't talked to them. Actually, the mom's passed away. But the other friend I'm not going to name because I haven't talked to her in a long time. But the funny thing about this was I had no experience doing anything at all, ever. Not acting, not, you know, nothing. I'm like 14 years old at this point, and I'm just a guy going to like eighth grade, you know? She had a monster portfolio in tap dance and jazz.
Oh, no joke.
And like, she brings this big binder of scrapbook portfolio. And I'm like, what is that? And she goes, it's my portfolio. And I'm like, oh man, like I have no shot if people have this stuff. And we get there. And of course, there's hundreds and hundreds of kids, and I can't even tell you how many. And they just call us in, herd us in like sheep, you know, 10, 15 of us at a time. Take a Holy look. It's like, they're like, oh, that's it. Okay, great. Thank you for coming. Bye. Don't take a look at anybody's portfolios. Don't take a look at anything else.
Pure raw cattle call style.
Yeah, exactly. People don't realize that's what actually does happen in some of these some of these casting sessions, especially when you got hundreds or thousands of people. They're really just looking for a look at the time, and then Crazy. From the look they get the kid who ended up getting this movie. He never did another movie after that. By the way, this was his one and only movie.
Ooh, that's tough.
Yeah, it wasn't me, by the way.
It was not you.
But this was my first foray into film and the life of it, you know, and kind of like taking a look at a kind of a behind the scenes approach to it, you know.
I mean, I guess if I were in that same boat, I probably would have just been like, nah, this isn't for me. Like, I wouldn't get it. So it's interesting that you not just stayed with it. You made it all the way into becoming a filmmaker. I mean, you're a professional filmmaker is what you do for a living. You know, it's not like a thing you say. It's legitimately your career path. You're in the union, the whole thing. So it's kind of interesting that it ended up, and you're more on the directing side as opposed to you're now the a-hole making that decision.
Yeah. You know, now I'm an assistant director and, you know, producer in some spots and things like that. But, yeah, I mean, now I make some, you know, a lot of decisions and, you know, deal with all my people on set and things like that, make sure everything's running smoothly. But, back then, yeah, I was just a kid, you know, going to an audition that, you know, was there for about 10 minutes and was told, you're good, but not good.
It's funny. It's funny because they film, there's lots of weird stuff that's been filmed in the area. The most notable movie next to ours, of course. I mean, ours are the most notable movies. Yeah. But the biggest one I would say out of here is Close Encounters, right?
Right.
Because most of the time they don't even film, they fake Alabama for another state. Like Forrest Gump is not filmed in Montgomery or anywhere near Alabama. It's filmed in South Carolina, I believe, somewhere. And they usually follow, nowadays they follow tax incentives and all this business stuff. It doesn't matter. But Close Encounters of the Third Kind was filmed here. And we did work on a Frame 29 Films, a company Tony and I both had little portions of. We produced a doc on that, and you can go find it on Amazon. It's pretty interesting to see. This guy that put this doc together filmed everything. But this isn't a plug for it. We don't get any money for it, but the guy filmed it all behind the scenes. He didn't talk to any celebrities. It's all filmed with like people who live in Mobile who are in this movie. It's really fascinating. It's basically Tony's story if Tony had gotten the gig, is what it does, is it follows it. You would have been a little alien, most likely. Right, yeah. Just a little alien.
Yeah.
So it's just fascinating that occurs. I've met one other person in my life that was actually, I mean, here living local. You can go look at his house. You can see Richard Dreyfuss's house in the movie and all that stuff. But there was a guy that we know, and I don't know if you know this, but Todd Hall is actually in, not related, is actually in Close Encounters. There's a shot of a little boy with blonde hair. That's Todd, not the main kid. But there's a little boy that's sitting in a shot, and he kind of looks down the barrel of the camera when it happens. The camera passes over him, and that's young Todd just sitting there in the shot, which is always fascinating to me.
That's funny. Yeah, I actually didn't know that, but I knew there was a lot of people that I know that popped up in that film. Yeah.
There's a great piece from that doc, which is my favorite piece of the whole thing, and I'm going to spoil it, but you'll get there too. And anybody's seen it, but there's a bit where I forget the guy's name. There's a gentleman that his kids had never seen. They'd only seen static images of his mom, but his mom is in Close Encounters, but her scenes got cut. So when they released this DVD, special DVD years later, yeah, you know where I'm going. They released this DVD years later. There's his mom and his kids for the first time get to see their grandmother. I mean, that's huge.
Right.
That is one of the most beautifully cinematic moments in the history of filmmaking where just a random thing occurs. And it goes back to what I think the essence of the show is. Yes, we have these beautiful houses of cinema that we would attend, these theaters that led us that. But just in this episode alone, we've talked about the impetus of my creative career, the partial impetus of your creative career. And then just that story, just that little tidbit of a story is another moment of where looking back on those and having that past and having that moment of where it's not about the star celebrity power and all that stuff. It's that the movies are an active part of our culture. They're part of our art or as the arts. And so it's a big deal that a lot of these things happen and they can make big changes. I just think it's really fascinating. The more we talk about this stuff, the more I go down this path of like, man, what a great moment. What a great sequence of stories to know you can draw a line back to those things.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the beauty of it. And that's kind of the beauty of this, this show as well, as far as I'm concerned, is we're talking about back for our future. And that's, you know, we've drawn this line where we started in 1992 with Wayne's World, and then we're all the way into 2011, 2012, hanging out at a bar with Paige Hamilton. And
right.
Then we, you know, draw it all the way back. And it's kind of a neat, you know, I mean, like those types of decisions and how little things that happened in your past led you to your future.
100%.
I kind of love it. And, you know, I've told you many times that those old theaters in Mobile were like my cathedrals. They're like kind of like my churches.
Yep.
You know, I mean, like I remember every single one of them. I remember what I saw there. I remember how they looked on the inside because they meant that much to me.
Right. Right. It's really an interesting journey. I'm excited to continue this portion of it as we go through. We're getting close to closing out for the show on our timeline here because we, you know, we try and keep this an hour because otherwise, I mean, as we told you guys, first episode, me and Tony could talk for 3 hours. I don't know if necessarily that's the best advisable move for anyone's life. I did see in the notes here, I didn't want to shortfall it. There's a couple movies that come out that year that are big to you, that are big influencers to you. And I didn't want to take that away. I wanted to make sure we touched on it. We're going to make it a little segment maybe of like Tony's favorites, some of, because Tony likes all movies, but a couple of Tony's favorites, notable moments or notable movies, whatever. I'll come up with a gimmicky name at some point, but go ahead and take it away. I'll let you just carry it out.
Hey, if I'm talking about Stopper, my mom will shoot twice in two episodes. You can tell I pretty much like everything. Okay,
that's accurate. Fair choice.
But you know, on March 29th, we lost a very important part of this era of film, and a very good actor, a very fine man, Louis Gossett Jr.
Yep.
Who I absolutely love his films. Growing up, and thought he was just one of the best, and all his films in the 70s and 80s. And I remember watching the movie The Principal with him and Jim Belushi with my grandfather. And he really had a kind of a profound effect on me watching films. But he has two big movies that he'll release in 1992. And one of them will be on June 12th, he'll release Aces Iron Eagle 3.
Yep. Yep.
So that's, you know, for people who liked the Iron Eagle franchise, this is the last big one that's in theaters. Didn't do all that well in the box office, but it was still a fun movie to watch. And he'll release that at the start of the summer. At the end of the summer, he'll have a movie that has an absolute big effect on my life, and that's the movie he's going to do with he releases on August 14th with James Woods, and it's called Digstown.
Oh yeah.
Watch this con artist boxing movie. You must see it. It's a great cast. Lou Gossett Jr., James Woods, Bruce Dern, Heather Graham, Oliver Platt. Absolutely wonderful film. If you've not seen it, check it out without a question. You're going to love it. I've never steered anyone to this film that didn't absolutely love it. So please check it out, and RIP to Mr. Lou Gossett Jr.
Yeah, shout out to him and his family and anybody else related. You know, we wish him the very best. Obviously influential. And I will tell you, Digstown is fantastic. I did not see it in 92. I don't know what year I saw it, but it was as an adult, and Tony told me to watch it. It was a fantastic film. Completely worth watching. Go back and do it. That's Tony's recommendation for the week.
Love this episode.
How about that? All right. With that being said, we're going to close out the show. Again, thank you so much for hanging out with us. We deeply appreciate it. We're happy to share part of our lives and our embarrassment. So maybe you get a laugh, but maybe you're inspired, and we look for you to do the same. So if you haven't had a chance, check us out on social media. We're all over the place. It's in the show notes. You can find us there. And with that said, Tony, you got anything you want to close with? I'll let you be the last word. The last word with Tony Nicknagiani.
No, just check us out. We got it in our show notes, but check us out on Twitter. Back for our future. At Back for Our Future with the number 4 instead of actually spelled out. Or you can email us at, you know, backforourfuture@gmail.com.
Perfect. There we go. See you guys very, very soon, and have fun at the movies. Didn't somebody else say that? I can't really say that.
Yeah, they did. They used to in Cisco in Europe, but yeah.
Those sons of guns. We'll have to come up with our own. All right. Well, here's the closing, generic closing line.